From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, author Sam Quiñones looks at surging heroin addiction in his new book, Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic, which just won the National Book Critics Circle Award. And award-winning actor Don Cheadle tells us how he prepared for his role as Miles Davis in the upcoming biopic, Miles Ahead. But first, the terrorist attacks in Brussels have once again raised questions on how the United States and other nations should combat the threat posed by ISIS. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, is among the many scholars exploring U.S. strategy against radical jihadists. He joins us now from New York. Richard Haass, always good to have you on this program, sir.
Good to be back.
Let me start with some comments that I heard you make on NBC and want to get you to expound upon them a bit more on our program for those who might not have seen you. You were a bit critical, my word, a bit critical of the way the president handled this or mishandled this Brussels terror attack while he was outside the country. Tell me more about what you thought the president should or should not have done.
Look, I was glad he went to Argentina. I had no problems also with the policy change toward Cuba. It's something of an experiment to see if it works. The only thing I was questioning were some of the optics, in particular the tango, quote-unquote, in Argentina. But I thought way too much got made of that. And again, the president of the United States has to be able to travel and also continue to look after business. And you don't want the terrorists to be able to essentially control your agenda. So it's always a fine line between business as usual and reacting to events. So I was just raising one small issue, and I think probably too much was made of it.
Okay. Let me ask, since you mentioned Cuba and described it as an experiment, and we will see what happens. I'm paraphrasing what you've just said. Tell me more what you really think about what the president has done now, resetting the deck, as it were, where Cuba is concerned.
Well, it really is something of an experiment. I find it one of the more interesting case studies now going on in American foreign policy. As you know, for more than half a century, the United States put enormous pressure on the Cuban government through economic sanctions, economic isolation. Whole idea was to bring it down or to change it to make it a more open, democratic place. It obviously didn't work. So with the end of the Cold War, Cuba's strategic significance has waned dramatically. So this president has essentially decided to do as much as he could without changing the fundamentals of the embargo, which Congress controls, and essentially said, look, we're going to open up. We're hoping that through various forms of economic interaction, tourism, what have you, that we set in motion dynamics in Cuban society that in turn would make it more open politically and more, say, market-oriented economically. Now, Congress, for the most part, is saying, first, we need to see steps by Cuba to become more open. So it's a question not of where we want to get, but how we get there. So Congress is arguing Cuba needs to do some things first. Mm-hmm. Then we would respond. The president's saying, let's do some things first, and it will change Cuba. It's an experiment. I think it's worth trying, and we'll simply see what happens.
Is it worth trying in light of the fact that many believe that Cuba has not made the progress it ought to make on human rights violations? Is it worth trying given those violations that continue?
Well, that's the real policy question. We're taking away the argument by the regime that they would be a more successful place if only they didn't have to deal with American economic pressure. So they can't blame their situation as much on us now going forward. What the president needs to do, or his successor is going to need to do, is keep an eye on the problem of human rights, on the dissidents, figure out a way to continue to reach out to them, not ignore them. On the other hand, still place the bet that over time this will lead to a more open Cuba. At some point, I think it's fair, whether it's 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, for some future occupant of the White House saying, hey, we've tried this. Unfortunately, it's not working, if that's the case. And then we can ratchet back on the economics. But I think after 50 years, there's a fair argument to say the old approach wasn't working. Let's at least try a new approach, but not ignore it. It's almost like in business when you sometimes create a startup. You don't ignore it. You don't stop looking at it. You keep your eye on it. And I think we need to keep our eye on it. And we can adjust this. We can tweak this. We can either become more or less open economically, depending upon whether the Cubans become more or less open politically.
We'll move on. But I think that the one thing I might take exception with you with respectfully is that once you let American business get into Cuba, it's hard to back that down. You can talk about tweaking and adjusting, but once they get their foothold on that island, I don't think you back down so easily, Richard.
Right, but we still have the embargo in place. Congress hasn't moved on that. I think your point is fair. There's some things that probably are going to be irreversible. It's not fair to American businesses to have them make a major investment
right.
and then to suddenly flip a switch and say, hey, the rules of the game have changed. But there's some things we ought to be saying you can't do yet, and that can only happen if we see certain types of progress down the road. I think that's the kind of thing that can probably be modulated, mm-hmm. but I take your point, Tavis.
Well, you're the expert. I was just offering another point of view. Let me now move to Brussels, which clearly is no laughing matter. And I don't mean to make light of the precious life that was lost in Brussels. And yet it's hard to ignore, in part because they've already admitted it, how much the authorities in Brussels bungled this before the attack happened. And now on the other side of the attack, they've had to let someone out because they arrested someone who had nothing to do with it. So mistakes made before, mistakes still being made after. What's your sense of how this was mishandled from the very beginning?
Well, mishandled is right. You've got way too many separate agencies within places like Belgium. And people speak of Europe as this large functioning bureaucracy. It's actually a large non-functioning bureaucracy in many places. So you not only have a problem of agencies talking to one another within countries, they're not sharing the information across borders. It's a little bit like we had at 9/11, where the FBI and the CIA and local law enforcement weren't talking. You have versions of that going on in Europe. Mm-hmm. Certain information was not acted upon and so forth. Not a lot changed after Paris. And what worries me is probably not a whole lot will change now. There's real bureaucratic and organizational inertia. There's still national concerns, suspicion of other countries. Europe has its own thinking about privacy and how to protect individual rights as opposed to thinking about collective security. So my guess is we're not going to see a transformation. Plus, there's the basic problem itself. You've got these large communities of individuals who are not assimilated, who are not integrated into these societies. And that, to me, is a real problem, getting exacerbated by all the returnees from places like Syria. And by the way, they don't have a handle on all the people who have gone to Syria, so they're not going to have a handle on all the people coming home, many of whom are going to re-enter Europe with say, a Belgian passport or what have you. So this is a condition more than a problem. And by that, I mean this is a condition, this is a situation that's going to endure. There's not going to be a single or a simple solution of any sort.
I hear your point about condition, and you're obviously right about that, to my mind. And yet I wonder how one changes that condition, because if you take the extreme approach, which is that every country in the EU decides to just close its borders and they get really, really nasty and really strict about that, that's one approach. And then, again, who knows how successful that might be anyway. But because the borders seem to be sort of so porous, and to your point, people sort of come and go. I mean, one comes to understand, I think, why this continues to happen in that region of the world, but not so much here on our soil.
Well, you've got the problem. One of the central themes, if you will, of modern Europe is the openness of borders, the so-called Schengen Agreement, named for this town in Luxembourg where this agreement was put together. So to close the borders of Europe is not just a law enforcement or physical change. That's a real change to the political and economic essence that is the entire European project
right.
that's grown up over the last half century. So that's a big deal. And even that wouldn't be a solution, because you would still have people that could say come into France or come into Belgium who could cause havoc, and you already have people there who can cause havoc. That's why this is more than a cross-border problem at this point.
So what are we learning, we being the U.S. of A., what are we learning from the success, I hate to use that word, but the success that ISIS is having hitting the targets that it wants to hit?
Well, it seems to me it's two things. One's a good lesson and the other's a bad lesson. The good lesson is I think we've done a relatively better job of assimilating and integrating people here. We have roughly 3 million Muslims in this country, roughly 1% the U.S. population. And I think that one of the lessons of this is the importance of something of a melting pot, and that you maintain good relations with community leaders. You don't ostracize entire communities. You don't have, for example, bans on Muslims or things that make young Muslim men in particular feel they've got no future. So I think that's the good lesson of the United States. It's one of the reasons we're faring better. The bad side is what we've done or more often haven't done in the Middle East. That by the time you're thinking about homeland security and what you do here at home, you're playing catch up. What we've also learned is what we haven't done in particular in Syria has been extremely costly. If the 2003 Iraq War, and you and I have talked about that any number of times on the air, Tavis, if that was a major era of commission, I would believe that history will judge what this administration, for the most part, has not done in Syria as a major act of omission. And in foreign policy, doing the wrong things can get you in trouble just as much as not doing the right things can get you in trouble.
Putting you on the spot here, what's most concerning you about what's not being discussed vis-a-vis foreign policy on the presidential campaign trail?
Long answer. I worry about a couple of things. One is just some of the specific threats. I really worry about North Korea, which is probably during the span of the next president, particularly if that person's a two-term president, they're going to be able to put nuclear warheads on missiles that can reach the continental United States. What is it we do to try to prevent that coming about? What do we do if it coming about? I also worry about the disconnect between what's going on or not going on in this country and our ability to act in the world, the quality of our education, our immigration policy, the lack of reform, the lack of infrastructure modernization. Our federal debt is going to begin to balloon during the next presidency. So I add up all these things, and I worry about the foundations of American power. And connected to that, Tavis, it's the political divisions. I look at the debate or non-debate on trade. And I'm a big proponent of free trade. And even though it costs some individual jobs, it creates lots of jobs for Americans who are doing things that get exported. It's helped lower prices. It's increased consumer choice. It's been a critical thread towards making this world more orderly and creating confidence in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I worry about the turning away from this tradition of open trade. I think this will have not just economic costs, but I worry it could have real strategic costs.
I always appreciate the insights of the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Richard Haass. Richard, good to see you. We'll do it again soon. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. In mid-March, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued 12 guidelines for physicians aimed at easing the overuse of prescription painkillers like Vicodin and Percocet. These and other addictive opioids cause an average of 40 overdose deaths a day in America and often lead addicts straight to heroin. Author Sam Quinones documents how the prescription drug epidemic intersected with the explosive rise of heroin in his new book, Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic, which just won the National Book Critics Circle Award in the general nonfiction category. Sam, you've done it again, and it's good to have you on this program.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Let me just jump right in and say something that might be politically incorrect, but this is how it occurs to me.
Okay.
How it feels to me. You tell me how wrong or how close I am to being right.
All right, then.
It seems to me that this issue has gotten all the play that it is getting of late because this has become a real epidemic for white folk.
I don't agree.
Not at all.
Well, let me explain.
All right.
There are more people dying from this than dying from car accidents. That's an epidemic. Doesn't matter what race the people are. I think what's different in this case is that the response, the response is different. I was a crime reporter during the crack years.
Yeah.
And affected a lot of black folks in the folk town where I lived, which was Stockton, California. A very public crime. There wasn't a large hue and cry for more incarceration, for a sterner response to that problem. I would say a lot coming from the black community, frankly, as well. There was not at that time a response that involved treatment for addicts, for crack addicts. And in fact, I met many crack addicts who were, I remember several breaking down in tears because they could not kick this thing. There was no way of getting over that. That's what's different this time around. I believe this is clearly an epidemic. Doesn't matter what race you are. If there's more people dying from this than car accidents in the country, then that's an epidemic. But what's different is the response, I think. The response is we need to treat this as a disease now. We need to treat this with treatment, with rehab, and more money devoted to that. I've seen many people come before me and say, at talks and whatnot I've given,
right,
and say, you know, my son, there's only two alternatives for my son, the street or prison or jail, you know. And I said, well, that's kind of what everybody supported. Mm-hmm. 25 years ago, we had an opportunity to have a more multifaceted approach to drug addiction, and nobody took it. Now, a couple of things that are getting in the way of that, and that is the crack epidemic was very public. It was a very public violence. You could not – I covered many drive-by shootings. I went – where there's phalanxes of crack dealers in public, and it destroyed neighborhoods, businesses, schools, families, you name it, a very public way. This has not been public. I would say the opposite is true. Because it's a white problem, it has been quiet. And that's because people in that community, mainly middle class, but also rural folks, suburban folks, are mortified. The fact that their son is addicted to heroin. They send him off for 9 months. They make up a lie about where he went. He dies. They say it was a heart attack or something like that. Or simply, they don't say anything at all. My problem was, when I was writing this book, was that people would not talk about it. It was very quiet. This has been going on 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's only the last two that's been getting any kind of play.
To my ears, respectfully, I think you do agree with me. I think you just made my point, maybe without knowing you made it, which is that the reason why there's been a hue and cry about this being seen primarily as a health crisis, as one of criminal conduct, is because the persons who are being victimized and abused by this don't have such the kind of melanin in their skin the way that I do. And so now it's health crisis.
No, you're completely
let me take
right.
your argument and flip it.
Right.
When crack was doing all the damage you just suggested that it did, and clearly it did that, wasn't nobody saying this is a health crisis?
No. That's true. No, that's why I say in the book. I came upon this talking with a judge in Nashville.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, 20 years ago, he started a drug court in Nashville to provide alternatives to prison for folks who were arrested for drug crimes. Right. And he had a hell of a time getting funding in 1996, 98, 2000. He battled, built it on his own. It's an amazing drug court, worth people visiting. Right about 3-4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, he begins to notice a change himself. And that's what you say. It's like people saying, hey, you know, a legislator calling him who wouldn't give him a dime maybe 10 years ago. Now he's saying, hey, the star quarterback on our team is addicted, or the guy who goes to my church, his son's addicted. Absolutely. That's what's happened. The people have come to a new perspective on what the response should be. That's really what's radically different now.
Yeah.
And I do believe it's because it's mainly white folks who are getting addicted. It's folks with access to power. I think that's a big one.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, the face of this illness is a face that we have to reckon with, because it's happening to people that are beloved by the American public.
Exactly. Yeah. And who have access themselves. Their families can call up that state legislature. Mm-hmm. I believe a lot of this started at the state legislature level. Mm-hmm. Kentucky, Virginia, Indiana, Ohio, places like that. And it's spreading across the country to now where it's a federal issue. But most of those folks said, you know, began calling their legislators. And that's what this judge in Nashville was seeing. All of a sudden, he's getting calls. Hey, can I get my nephew into your program? From a legislator who before 10 years would have shut the door on him. So it's the response, in my opinion. This has been way late in becoming noticed because everyone's quiet about it.
Yeah.
But the response to crack is very different from what was to crack.
I only raise that issue primarily because I think one of our roles, if we're trying to tell the truth, for those of us who care about the truth, is to shine a spotlight when necessary on the hypocrisy in America.
Yeah.
So that when crack hits one community, we want to throw the book at people. Then it's three strikes and you're out.
Right.
That's that era where three strikes, to your point, comes on the books.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, can you get my kid into a program? So I just wanted to point out the hypocrisy.
Absolutely. And I believe this book was the first one to report that.
Exactly. So for those who are wondering why a book about America's opiate epidemic would be called Dreamland, explain what the
title is. You know, I thought that this was going to be a book about dope.
Yeah.
I'm a crime reporter from way back. I worked in Stockton, California, my first job.
Right.
And so I approached this as a job, a story about drugs and a crime story. And midway through, I realized that this was a very different story. This was a story about who we are as a country, what we've given up in the last 35 years in terms of community, what we've sacrificed as community, places we have like turned our back on the public sphere, seems to me. We have denied funding for the public sphere, roads, parks, all these things that government provides. We have demeaned government. We've laughed at government, saying the private sector is somehow this paragon of job-creating virtue and very efficient in government as a joke, you know. Along the same lines, we've also kind of turned inward. We know you go out and you go to parks, no one plays in the parks. Everyone's in front of a screen. When I was growing up in L.A. in the 1960s, anyone who spent time indoors was kind of like a mama's boy, you know? I mean, really, that was the way it was. And now nobody goes outside. We're all terrified of the public sphere, right? We're all, and so Dreamland was a kind of a, it was a reference to a pool in a small town in southern Ohio, which was the center of life itself, a town of Portsmouth, Ohio. They had a pool the size of a football field. It was all encompassing. You grew up at the pool as a toddler. By the time you have kids, you're in the deep end. Then you bring your kids back to the shallow end. It was this beautiful place where people kind of raised each other, grew together, and that pool was destroyed because they just didn't have the funding to keep it going in the early 90s, and that left that town completely vulnerable to something as isolating as opiate addiction, heroin addiction, and that beautiful, glorious pool, which was just so enormous and the source of so many memories from people who have left that town, fell apart. It was replaced by Walmart. That's the only place in that town really where people now have a chance to get together. And this is really what I thought was a kind of a metaphor for the whole country when it comes to heroin. Again, it became went from a drug story to something more about who we are as a people and what we have sacrificed. And now it's all about isolation. Everybody's isolated. We got one response to pain, that's pills. Yeah. We got nobody kind of getting together and playing in the parks, watching each other, kind of community reinforcement in a sense. And so what is the result? Heroin's like the poster drug for 35 years of fostering values that turn away from the public and foster and prize the private. And that's kind of why it was an amazing story. I mean, the story of that pool just destroyed that town.
On the cover of the book, you will read these words: the relentless marketing of pain pills, crews from one small Mexican town selling heroin like pizza. The collision has led to America's greatest drug scourge. When we think today of drug lords, we think of El Chapo.
Yeah.
But the story that you tell in this book of this small Mexican town selling heroin like pizza is a fascinating story, which I wanted you to tell a bit of now, because this ain't El Chapo.
That's why I liked it.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, pharmaceutical companies marketed their pain pills in a very direct way. They would go to the doctors, hey, these pills, we now know these pills are no longer addictive when used to treat pain. There was like this very personal relationship. This town, guys who would come here, developed this system that was very much the way pharmaceutical companies marketed pills. They marketed heroin that way. Convenience, customer service, contact with and so it's a system whereby you, the addict, will call a number, operators standing by conveniently to take your order. The operator will call a driver. The driver will go meet you at the Burger King parking lot in your town or wherever, and you'll make the deal. And that's how it goes, 7 in the morning to 7 at night. It's a system started here, not far from where we're sitting in San Fernando Valley, and spread all across the country. It was a kind of a vanguard of a new way of selling drugs, which I thought was always accompanied by public violence. The Colombians, crack, all that stuff. No, these guys are all quiet. No guns. They look like day workers in front of a Home Depot. They're not spending their money, this kind of thing. They're out there just selling insidiously, giving free discounts, free, kind of like you buy 6 days, I'll give you a free one on Sunday, that kind of thing, you know? And so this system was a vanguard kind of a new way of selling drugs, I believe, is really kind of a more kind of 21st century way of drugs. But it was also because of that system, they were also the first ones to understand that there was a huge new market emerging of pill addicts who one day, if you just stuck with it, one day would become heroin addicts. And that's also their importance to the story.
What does this book, Dreamland, tell us about the toll that this opiate addiction has taken on America?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it, to me, it feels like, first of all, that there is, first of all, it's destroyed families. It's not one person who gets addicted in a family. It's aunts and uncles and grandparents, mom and dad and siblings. Everyone is involved in this. So for every addict, you have 15 people, 20 people maybe. And so you've got massive communities, mass numbers of communities all across this country that are being just kind of clawed apart by this stuff. The other thing that's interesting, I think, about this that I did not know when I started this book was that this is a drug. This especially, all addiction is like this, but these drugs especially really deprive you of free will. You have free will to take it the first time, first few times. Once you're addicted, it's almost like it's very, very difficult to stop because it kind of controls physically. It controls your brain and your body. And unlike maybe gambling or maybe even crack, actually, it's not really that difficult to kick. What it also means is that this also changed my view on why these things start. For a long time, living in Mexico for 10 years, it becomes easy to believe that demand up here is the problem. And that's true. I'm not saying that's not true, but this was a supply-driven problem. This was created by excess supply, doctors prescribing pills for all manner of things, for wisdom teeth extract. 5 million people get their wisdom teeth extracted every year, and each one of them gets 60 Vicodin. Almost every one of them gets 60 Vicodin. Every time they go, that's 300 million pills of Vicodin for one little routine surgery. You got, and that's all across the country. You got all kinds of new procedures and routine surgeries are being prescribed for this, as well as chronic pain. All of this. This means that the supply is massive. At the same time, you've got this massive new supply coming from Mexico. All our heroin comes from Mexico or Colombia now. Another one comes from Turkey, like in the 70s. So you've got a whole new supply of very cheap, very potent, very prevalent heroin. That means you can talk all you want about, great, let's do more treatment, and I believe that to be true. You've got to do that. But what happens when you get out of treatment and you face this tidal wave of supply in your face, pills here, heroin there, so easy to get, people giving it to you conveniently, that's really a major problem.
Is it fair to say then that the medical profession has been complicit in this problem?
Oh, yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Yeah. Well, look, a lot of doctors, most doctors are well-meaning, and they believe that this was a way of treating very serious problem, which is pain in their patients. And why do you become a doctor if not to assuage pain, But same time, they bought the pharmaceutical company slash pain specialist line that these pills could be prescribed without risk of addiction. Yeah. 3,000 years of history be damned. We know that these are now not addictive, and that was nonsense.
Do we have any way... Is there any data that tells us in any compelling way what we know about the percentage or numbers of people who got addicted because of
that
pain, legitimate pain versus I want to get a high?
I don't know that there's any. There's a paucity of studies and that there's just nothing available in a lot of this stuff. But I run into people all the time, you know. Football players, I believe football is now a gateway to heroin addiction, and that's an amazing statement to be able to make. It's true because people get prescribed these, you know, football is just nothing but creating chronic pain. And so you get these pills for that. You don't get much training in how to use them, any explanation of the risk, and all of a sudden then you get addicted. I've heard these stories over and over and over. Whether there's a study of how many people or use them according to doctor's orders and still get addicted, I haven't seen one, but I would imagine it to be on the 20-40% range, something like that.
The new book from Sam Quiñones is called Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Sam, great research, great writing. Good to have you on the program.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks very
much. Good to see you. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. There were a few jazz musicians in history as talented and as turbulent as Miles Davis. Capturing both his musical genius and mercurial personality is no easy feat, but Don Cheadle felt compelled to take it on, and he stars as Miles Davis and makes his directorial debut in the new film Miles Ahead, which debuted last fall at the New York Film Festival and opens in theaters this weekend. Don Cheadle joins us now to explain how he channeled Davis and approached his first foray behind the cameras. He also returns on April 10th, and I can't wait as Marty Kahn in season 5 of Showtime's House of Lies. Don knows how much I love that show. Before we start our conversation about the new film, a clip from Miles Ahead.
Oh, yeah, man. Y'all listening to them? That's how this shit's supposed to sound.
You hold that over to the next measure.
Hold that over the measure. And the letter is off.
Then it grew.
Yeah, that grew. We should get them back in.
Let's do it.
Let's get them back
Thanks,
in.
Man.
Tio, record this.
All right, guys, you're on rehearsal. Take 3.
Y'all, let's be musical about this. Be wrong, strong, okay? Otherwise, live out. Let's go, Gil. Count it off.
1, 2, 1, 2.
I was just telling you that was one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and you were saying you've been hearing that from other people as well.
Yeah. It was, you know, it's one of those scenes where in the script it just says Miles works on Gone.
Right.
There's no dialogue. There's no, we didn't write the scene really. It's the last day of shooting. And I said, I just need musicians. I just need people that can really play. And we're just going to work through the music. Just give us the charts and we'll just figure it out.
Yeah. I loved it because you feel in that part of the film, I mean, you feel this way throughout the film, but in that part, in a unique way, you feel a part of his world. You go inside the studio and see how he worked, how he got it. It's kind of like watching Michael Jackson on This Is It, when that, you got to see the way he did what he did.
Yeah.
But I love that scene because it takes you inside his world.
And it's great because we're not really acting, you know what I mean? It's like we're really trying to work out the music.
Yeah. Speaking of not acting, everybody who I've talked to who's seen this, including myself, is amazed at your playing. So you actually picked it up and started working on it.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, you see a lot of movies with actors playing musicians, and often they don't have a facility with their acts, and I didn't want to go in, and especially a movie about Miles Davis, and not have a real relationship with that trumpet.
Yeah. How difficult, or conversely, how fun was it for you?
No, it's the first word. It's definitely difficult. And unforgiving. You know, it's an instrument that you can't just put down and come back to and be the same a week later. Like, if you didn't shoot baskets for 5 or 6 days, you wouldn't start throwing the basketball over the back of the backboard. But if you don't play trumpet every day, you know, at least 2 or 3 days, it's like you feel like your lip, like you didn't know how to play.
Yeah. So what is the deeper, greater level of appreciation you have now for trumpet players?
Well, you know, I grew up playing in bands my whole life, and I always had that brass section sitting right behind me. I played sax, but they were always right there. And every once in a while, I'd try to, you know, figure it out. And my best friend played trumpet growing up. But yeah, actually, the demands of keeping it up is what's the most interesting part of it. You know, there was never a moment I could put the sax down and I could come back to it, and relatively quickly I'm there again. Mm-hmm. But with trumpet, you really feel like you're on fawn legs when you start.
What makes it so unforgiving, to use your word?
Because I think that the setup is just not natural. There's nothing that's natural about the way you have to create your embouchure to play.
Right.
And then everything you do during the day, eating, chewing, drinking, talking, works to like break that structure back down.
Right.
So you got to find it again, and you're trying to make a lot of noise through a very small aperture.
Yeah. I was pleasantly surprised, but again, taken aback when I actually saw the film, because it is as I said to you when you showed up today, the word I use, an unorthodox, try it again, Tavis, an unorthodox telling of his story. Yeah. Tell the audience what the story is and why you chose that as your way into a guy who
is unorthodox.
Exactly.
Well, I always thought that the telling of the movie should be befitting the subject matter. And we wanted to create a story that felt like a Miles Davis experience, you know, that you would experience with his music and a lot of the apocryphal things that I've heard about him, and having his family right there has been great, you know, to really let us see things that not a lot of people have seen and tell stories that other people haven't necessarily heard. But I wanted the film to, like I said, to feel like it's an experience. So when you go through the research and bump into this 5-year period where one of the most prolific figures in art, not just music, but in every aspect of the 20th century, goes quiet and doesn't play for 5 years, as a storyteller, you look at that and go, okay, well, that's my point of departure. Mm-hmm. That's a place where I want to figure out what happened, how did it happen, mm-hmm. what's in there, how does he get out of there, does he get out of there, mm-hmm. what does he say once he's out of there? You know, mm-hmm. what's going on in that moment? And use that as the place to start trying to have things all churn up to, like, push him out of his own way and get back to playing again.
Well, I just realized something here after 13 years of doing this show. I am not an artist. You just told me I'm not an artist because when I read that was going to be your way in, I'm like, now why would Don pick the 5 years when the Negro wasn't playing?
Right.
As the way to tell the story about a guy who we love because of what he played.
That's right. Yeah.
But when I saw it, I understood why.
Yeah, and it's kind of famously very meta in the way for Miles. You know, it's like play what's not there is one of the biggest things that he said. And then you kind of feel like, well, here's a down note. Here's a not. What's not their moment to try to craft a story around this artist and use all of the music. I didn't want to be locked into specific dates with mm-hmm. the specific time periods that we were depicting. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if I want to be in 1958 and use something from 1982, I want to do that mm-hmm. and vice versa. So co-writer Stephen mm-hmm. Begelman and myself just wanted to create a story that felt like a Miles Davis experience. You know, my goal was to do Don Cheadle is Miles Davis, as Miles Davis in mm-hmm. Miles Ahead, mm-hmm. you know?
I get that. So how much creative license, as they say in this town, was taken in the project?
A lot, but no more than other biopics, mm-hmm. quote unquote, that mm-hmm. we've seen. And there are tons of facts in there. You know, mm-hmm. it is wall-to-wall facts without me, you know, mm-hmm. getting a book and going, okay, check that off fact, check that off fact, check that off fact. We sort of took the puzzle and pushed the pieces up in there and then reformed it in the way that we wanted to mm-hmm. tell the story that we wanted to tell. But, you know, those recordings, that's real, all of that, the secret recordings, mm-hmm. the Dave Braden character, the reporter that's trying to get this story is an amalgam of many people at that period mm-hmm. in Miles' life that were trying to get in to either write the obituary or the comeback. They didn't know which one it would be. Mm-hmm. Frances, obviously, is absolutely mm-hmm. real, and that whole B story is real.
And a great actress.
Yeah, Imiazzi Corinelli. Yeah.
Cast beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having done this now, and we'll come to your directing in a second, but I'm just talking about the acting piece. Having done this now, is Miles Davis more complicated or more simplified for you now? As a person?
Huh. That's a good question. And I don't know that it's binary.
Okay.
I think sometimes it's both.
Okay.
You know, I think when I look at the consistency of his journey, mm-hmm. It is always someone who is searching for the next thing and trying to hear the next sound. And, you know, right before he passed, he was making music with Prince.
Yeah.
So he was never finished, and he never wanted to go back. He always wanted to figure out what the next thing was, and that's something when you look at his life and his work throughout his life is totally consistent. Mm-hmm. But he was a complex figure, and he was someone who always put the music before anything. Mm-hmm. So when you're in relationship with a person like that, be it as a friend, a lover, a wife, a husband, a coworker, whatever, you are often that which is left in the wake mm-hmm. to greater or lesser degree. But I also think that you understand that that's the contract, you know? Mm-hmm. And the people in Miles' life were the beneficiaries often of his creative genius and what he was able to produce, mm-hmm. but also sometimes got their wings, you know, burn mm-hmm. and they fly that close to the sun. Yeah.
I wondered whether or not it was his confidence that led to his curiosity, or his curiosity that built and fueled his confidence. And what I'm getting at here is, I mean, he knew he was good. I mean, obviously there's some confidence here. Mm-hmm. And yet he was such a curious person, as you said earlier, he would try so many different things, not always knowing whether those things were going to work or not.
Yeah.
But what's the relationship between his confidence and his curiosity?
Well, I think that the confidence, what belies that sort of facade to mm-hmm. me, the cool, mm-hmm. and, you know, you hear things like Miles used to think, is it cooler to tap my whole foot mm-hmm. to keep time or just tap my foot inside my shoe? Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like the most confident person in the yeah. world in that way. That's like, oh, that's something that reveals a vulnerability to mm-hmm. me, that you're thinking about how you're perceived. It looks mm-hmm. like Miles could care less and just did whatever he wanted to do, and if you got whatever. But there's someone who's very thoughtful there, and a lot of people that knew Miles very well said that he was incredibly sensitive. And when you listen to the music, of course he was.
Yeah.
You know, that you can't, a monster is not producing those, yeah. that beautiful music. Yeah. And a lot of what he put on was to protect this, you know, softer part of him, this yeah. part from which he created, which is, you know, can be fragile. Yeah. And people were at him a lot.
Yeah.
And this sort of like tough guy image, this stay at arm's length image, a lot of times was protection. A lot mm-hmm. of times it was other things too.
Yeah.
But that was a part of it that was interesting to understand the vulnerabilities that this yeah. super cool dude had.
I was about to say, and this is my take on it, others will have their own opinion when they see it, but I think they'll agree with me on this, that you did a really, really good job, particularly for a directorial debut, a really good job of finding and balancing that confidence and that vulnerability. There are scenes in here where, I mean, I took away a number of lessons about his vulnerability, but how he managed them as well. There's some scenes in there that really, I'm like, Miles did have some vulnerabilities. Because to yeah. your point, he seems on stage like the most confident. Any cat that can get on stage and turn his back to you
yeah.
and play is a cat who's got some confidence, yeah. man. Yeah.
And then, you know, whether it's true or not, you know, I understand it. Miles would say, you know, does a conductor face the audience when they conduct? Yeah. I'm dealing with my band.
Yeah.
We're trying to work on stuff and yeah. find things. And he would walk around the stage to see acoustically what pockets mm-hmm. sounded better where he was playing. And some of it was attitude.
Yeah.
But the thing that I liked about Miles and about the way he worked is that it was all about process. Mm-hmm. It was all about process, you know. He didn't introduce songs because he's like, I'm not going to get up and do the sort of entertainment thing. Mm-hmm. I'm actually doing something that's a lot more ingratiating to you in a way, which is going, come look at how we work on stuff. Mm-hmm. Come see the journey, because mm-hmm. that's really what they were about. You know, yeah. Herbie said Miles paid them to practice in front of people, mm-hmm. you know, not come yeah. down and do your polished, perfect work, yeah. but to let's all be out here and try to figure some stuff out together.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Herbie, how cool was it? I'll fast forward to the end of the film. Yeah. When you're on stage with Herbie and Wayne Shorter and Esperanza Spalding, and you're playing with them.
And Gary Clark Jr. And Gary Clark Jr., yeah. And Antonio Sanchez yeah. and Rob Glasper. No, I was
how
like...
How cool is that?
The whole, yeah. you know, that was enough of an excuse to do the movie right yeah. there. I mean, I had no idea that we were able... that we wanted to be
yeah.
able to do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was someone who, you know, came up sort of, you know, surrounded
yeah.
with musicians and in that sweet spot of that creativity and that yeah. creation, it was great to be there with these masters who yeah. just do it all the time.
Yeah. Speaking of masters, Carlos Santana was sitting in that chair just a few weeks ago as a guest on this program. I'm always pleased to have him. And I've gotten so much mail from people, you know, literally snail mail, email, from folks who saw that conversation. Because Carlos, at one point, seemed to suggest that he was advanced, enhanced, by the drugs that he took, as opposed to suffering artistically from being drugged up. I raise that because in the movie, you don't shy away from Miles' cocaine use.
Yeah.
You know, Miles isn't here to answer this, but what's your sense of whether or not that aided and abetted him artistically, or whether it got in the way of what could have been even a greater iconic repertoire?
Well, I think often it's not but, it's and,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And again, if we were going to parse it, I mean, we had him on the couch, maybe, and a therapist was here. They mm-hmm. could talk him through it, and yeah. we could find the moments where, like, now that's probably the coke didn't help you there. And I imagine the heroin at that point wasn't really additive.
Yeah, yeah.
But we also do know that drugs do open up different centers, and yeah. they do make different connections that you would make when you were not high.
Mm-hmm.
It is a slippery slope,
mm-hmm.
and... One is not necessarily benefiting the other.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it was really bad for Charlie Parker because mm-hmm. it didn't stop his playing. It didn't have a negative effect until everything caught up.
Mm-hmm,
sure. But he could get high and play unbelievably to the rafters and mm-hmm. things that no one could imagine they could ever hear coming out of a sax.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in many ways, led to his undoing. That if he had lost all of his facility, I don't know, he was hooked. Maybe he would have been able to be more in a position to quit, but probably not. I mean, we've seen many, many greats. This isn't a new story, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. The presence of drugs with this kind of genius that seems to be boundless.
Yeah. The relationship that we see in the film, the acidic relationship that we see in the film that Miles had with the record company at that time, was that typical of the way he tended to get along or not get along with record executives?
Well, you know, again, some of that is dramatized.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think specifically his relationship with George Butler ultimately was very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George sent him a piano. George was at him to come back,
mm-hmm.
but not in a way that was necessarily combative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we portray him that way in the film, but he was saying, hey, man, we'd come back. You know, we'd love to hear your voice again and get you back in the studio and get you working. And he did, during this period of time, record this session that was never released.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people haven't heard. I've heard it. I think you can find it online if you dig around. But he was often, you know, there's famous notes that he sent, you know, to the to the studio, just with like a number and a date.
Exactly.
Send it.
Yeah.
Where's it at? Let's go. You know.
Let me shift from the acting now to the directing. So it is it cool for you to hear that term, directorial debut?
Sure. When you say it, it rolls off really nice.
No. So what's your takeaway from this this maiden voyage?
Oh man, it was a tricky way to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and a tricky subject. That's why I high five you on that. As a matter of fact, I was like, if I were making my directorial debut, this is not the subject that I would have chosen.
Well,
that's a real.
I didn't set out to do that. That really was not the goal. I was not saying, well, let me find the hardest thing.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I would have found something easier.
The hardest way to do it. No, that wasn't. I wasn't. And when this all came to pass, it was because Vincent Wilburn
mm-hmm.
saw me in Devil in a Blue Dress, and he's like, "Oh, if we ever do a movie,
I love
Vince Miles. Yeah, he's great.
Hey, Vince.
Yeah, what's up, Vince?
What's up, Vince?
And it had been sort of swirling around, but he kind of made a declaration when Miles was being inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006, that they were going to do a movie and I was going to star as it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So I met with the family and I just pitched them this idea about how I kind of thought we should approach his life and the material and what the movie should feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a departure from the things that had been pitched to them before. So they were kind of excited about it. And I said, okay, well, if somebody writes that, mm-hmm. then, you know, let me know and I'd love to do it.
Yeah.
But it became apparent pretty quickly that if that was how it was going to be done, it was probably going to take me to do it. And it's something that I tried to give away a few years ago. I tried to find another director for the part so that I could just focus on the acting, and I didn't want that responsibility. But everybody that I pitched it to were both doing their own thing and were also saying, but this is your movie. This is your vision. This is your whole thing, so why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
I was like, because I don't want to die, you know? I don't want to be hospitalized at the end of it. But ultimately, it fell to me to do it, because that's the only way it was going to get done.
I thought that the estate, the family, was very generous in the story that they allowed you to tell, because I think you intimated this early in this conversation, that some of that stuff, I mean, we see these stories that get sanitized and sterilized and deodorized.
All of it.
And then it flops because everybody know it ain't real.
Exactly.
But I thought
you got to do the PG version of it, and it's like, really? James Brown PG? But whatever.
Yeah.
If it had not been Miles, and I think if they did not understand really what his quest had been in his entire life, it would have been much more difficult. Had they not been themselves artists and understand creativity. They would not necessarily have been down for something that was more in line with what he would have done, they believe, than something that he would have wanted to see done about him. And he has famously kind of gone in on movies that were about historical figures, musicians that felt like sort of cookie cutter things that he'd seen before. He was like, I don't want that. So whenever we would discuss the film and how we wanted to go about it, I, you know, because I wanted them on board the whole way and was totally deferential to what they wanted out there. I said, do you think that he would want something like what we've seen before in these kinds of movies that feel like cliff notes of the person's life? Or do you think he'd want something that's wild and, and gangster and feels like it's chasing itself down a hole and then comes out of the other and just feels like it's got some drive in it? And they'd be like, nah, that's do that. And Miles wasn't shy about his behavior ever. You know, he didn't wasn't trying to hide his drug use, his relationship with women. And he was like, yeah, I did all that stuff. And he very much regrets his relationship with Francis and, and how that all came to pass. And they were friends afterwards. So it's a very complicated relationship in that regard. And he has been on record being really open with all of it.
Yeah. So now that you have survived, you didn't die, didn't kill you.
Right.
They say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
I don't think that's been proven medically. I think what they say is that stress actually kills you.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what we've learned?
Yeah. So I guess the question is, did you enjoy it enough to want to do it again?
Not like that.
Okay.
I don't think.
But you do
like
want to direct again, though.
Yeah. Okay. I would direct again.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that was too many things to freight it with.
Yeah.
But I felt like I went to school and got my cum pro directorate.
Yeah.
Cum pro directorate.
I got you.
That's what I got on that movie.
And I thought you were going to say, you know, I'll direct again, but I don't want nothing to do with that Cheeto guy again, man.
Yeah,
I don't want to direct that Cheeto guy again.
Yeah, he was a drag. Yeah.
All right, well, can you tell me, I got a minute to go, and I can't end this without asking about my man, Marty Khan. April 10.
We'll be back.
You're back on Showtime.
That's right.
What, you shot in Cuba?
Yes, we did.
How cool was that?
It was very interesting. Yeah. I mean, have you been?
Oh, yeah, a couple times.
So you know that country needs something.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you go over there potentially with this exoticism of like, oh, the people and the music, and it's going to be, and then you get over there and it's like, there is that, but there's also like, there's a lot of depression here, and there's a lot of sadness and poverty, and we hope that there will be some sort of an exchange, not just culturally, but there will be an ability to have the trickle down, which when does that ever work? But I hope it will.
Yeah.
When this infusion of capitalism happens, that the people can get uplifted. You know, when the guy in the hotel who's bringing your towels is a surgeon, you know, and he's got to work in the hotel to make chips and you know, the your waitress is a physicist, and you're like, this is what you do? You're like, yeah, I've trained in school for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. You know, they need something.
Yep. From your mouth to God's ears.
There we go.
Yeah. Miles Ahead is the film that Don Cheadle stars in and directs this weekend. I highly recommend it, if that means anything to you. I enjoyed it. And Marty Khan is back on House of Lies on Showtime on April the 10th. And Mr. Cheadle, you're welcome here anytime you want, sir.
I'll be back.
Good to see you, my friend.
Thank you.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.